I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Darren from London, and you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. And my question is, if you had to be stuck in one decade for a week, which one would you choose? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast for myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello!
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked, and we're talking everything from...
Everything from Darren from London's question, which decade would you like to be stuck in for a week? Now, I think we're going to have to limit that to the 20th century. Maybe, you know, if you want to be in the early 21st century, fine. Dane, where do you stand on that? I think a lot of people have a lot of love for the 60s, but there may be some complications.
I'm pretty okay with everything prior to 1968. And if I'm really honest, like, really anything prior to... even up until when I was born. So I'd say maybe the 90s probably. Because the 80s had recession. Musically, it was a golden age. And with emergence of, like, grunge and then, like, more hip-hop started had more... hip-hop was, like, 80s, but more hip-hop was actually going gold and actually getting more of a... becoming a lot more diverse. Because in the 90s, it was kind of like... Biggie and Tupac, so that's kind of my time as well. So I would have said 80s as well, but then I feel like the 80s kind of taught us a lot about excess and being fine with excess, especially after the 70s, which was so much more of a socially conscious decade. And the 80s became a lot more materialistic. And that's kind of like, I think where we are now socially, we've kind of revived the 80s again as well, where we're kind of like giving up too much power to like the finance industry. So I'd say, that's why I'd say 90s.
I would agree with Dane, and I'd probably enjoy it more this time as well, because I didn't enjoy it when I was younger, so that would be quite good. But suffice to say, we ask and answer all the questions on this podcast, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely, we answer all questions. No question is too stupid, too big, or too small. If you like the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, or follow us on Spotify. You'll never miss an episode, or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's largest podcast network, to hear us answer all the questions from all of our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is a duo who have risen to prominence through their hit podcast. Their podcast has become one of the most popular in the UK, winning Podcast of the Year and Best Sex and Relationship Podcast at the British Podcast Awards. One of the pairing is a successful producer with credits on BBC Three's Things Not to Say To and Free Speech. And the second member of this duo is the journalist and presenter for C4 and Vice. But most importantly, they are just good human beings. So please, welcome to the show, Rabina and Poppy from Brown Girls Do It Too.
Hey!
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello. Brown Girls Do It Too, but hello, ladies, full-grown, cognitive, intelligent, insightful women. So they're very clear. I'm not trying to
infantilize. Thanks for that intro.
Oh, my pleasure. Asked for that to be inserted, didn't
they? I like that disclaimer.
Women, actually. We're women.
Yes. I want to make it very clear. Women. And
would you be offended if someone referred to you as girl, Rabina?
No.
No, neither would I.
I guess it's a good point, because I suppose it's always context, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
I think also it's actually easier when you use "girl" as a cumulative phrase, right? So like, if I said to you, "Oh, me, Rabina, she's a nice girl," you'd be like a little bit patronizing. When you'd be like, "Oh, it's the girls," or "Oh, it's the boys."
Yeah. I think it's down to tone as well, tonation. If we were outside having a cigarette, and you're like, you know that. Rabina's a really nice girl. Then I'd be like,
why would I have changed my voice?
Your
voice would be one question.
You're smoking.
Yeah, you're smoking as well. So it's just, you're like, or if like a waitress says, "Would you like something to drink, sir?" And you go, "I'll have a glass of scotch, please." And then you go, "Good girl." I'd go,
Good girl's not the one.
Or if I don't call her over.
If you flip it though, I prefer girl weirdly to mom. When someone refers to me as madam or mom, I'm like...
Who refers to you as mom?
Literally, I got ID'd for alcohol the other day. I had to take... I mean, obviously inside I was like, Yes. I took my mask off. I was like, I have to look 17. I have to be 17 right now. Do you think I'm 17? He's like, no, madam. I was like, okay, cool. But mom, I take offense to. I really do, because I'm like, don't be a dick. Don't do that to me.
Even if you're in Alabama, although I feel like that might be the least of your worries. Because that'd be more like, could you please leave the store, man? We don't serve you can here.
Get out of the store, man, before I shoot you with my AK-47. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, that's a different mom.
That's a different mom.
Different kind of mom, you know. That's a US mom.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I'm talking about South London mom.
Yeah, South London mom is like, I'm sorry, am I running CID? Are we doing an operation?
I tell you what also I've noticed is my use of the phrase guys, which at one point I would have associated with men, but I do not associate with men anymore. So occasionally I'll say, hey, you guys might have an opinion about this. And they'll go, oh, God, I'm a woman. Am I still a guy? I think, I don't know.
Oh, I do the same. In every email, I'm like, hey, guys. And no one's called me. No woman has called me out and said, yeah, you're removing my gender by not referring to
me. I don't think anybody is that particular about it. Again, I think it's always down to context. That being said, I always like to do a caveat sometimes when I'm performing, and I will say, ladies and gentlemen, gays and lesbian, and members of the non-binary community. And I say,
you'd be there for some time then.
That's it. Well, you know what? It makes for a great intro. It saves a bit of time as well. But then, you know, you have to read the room, and sometimes there is a time when you need to kind of be inclusive and stuff. And as I said, I think people kind of know. Because even, I think... So girls sometimes, like I said, as a colloquial, doesn't necessarily mean you're pertaining to gender anyway. Because, like, I suppose if I had, like, my gay uncle was like, girl, you need to leave her and treat yourself better, I'd be like, that's sound advice. That's sound advice. I totally get that.
Yeah, and there's something really beautiful about other women calling each other girls and having that. Like, it's girl power, right? It's not women power. It's like there's something kind of sisterly about it.
Yeah, from a nice place of sorority as well. And I'd like to
reclaim the word lads to be non-binary. I think it's quite good fun to be able to, it feels like such a thing that's been going on for so many decades now. Like, we're the lads. You know?
Lads.
It'd be lovely to be like,
but we
are
some... my girls as lads.
Yeah. Which I think is cool. Good. Ladette was a thing, remember, in like the early noughties. They had like a few shows where it was like, do you know women drink beer while wearing trousers? We call them ladettes. What a crazy phenomenon. See, in the 90s, no one cared about that because women wore baggy jeans and lumberjack shirts anyway, and we were all fine. It wasn't that big of a deal. But then somewhere in the new century
I do call my boys girls too.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, well, I call the girls lads. I'm going to call you my girls because they are my girls.
I get that. I totally get that. I always use the same honorifics to refer to even a partner. I'd be like, fam, bro, fam. Well, go on, fam. Are you sure you don't have to wear a bra or wear indoors? You know?
You don't have to wear a bra. It's lockdown.
That's what I'm saying. Like, gee, there's no need for this underwear, bro. We're just going to dinner. So, you know, that kind of thing.
So it's probably time for a question, as the format of this show dictates, isn't it?
Absolutely. And as our very esteemed guests, Rubina and Poppy, we invite you to ask the first question, which we'd like to discuss for about 15 minutes of some change. Then Howard will ask a question, which we'll all answer and discuss again. And then lather, rinse, repeat. I will ask a question to both of you, which we will discuss. And then everybody have a nice life, a nice week. And my listeners get to find out where they can find out about more of your amazing works. Sound like a plan?
Plan.
Right, let's do it, lads. We would like the first question, please.
All right, so our first question is, do men really think about sex more than women?
Yep, next question. No, I'm joking.
That's the end of that.
We always love to know what inspired that question from you guys.
When we started our podcast, it was really apparent that Poppy and I had quite high sex drives and we were quite up for talking about sex quite graphically. And that's kind of led us to make Brown Girls Do It Too. And we only speak to girls on the podcast and all of our fans are girls. And I think we all think about sex quite a lot. But we've been told and taught this whole story that men think with their dicks and they're these kinds of things. And actually, how can you ever measure thought? There's no thought police. How can you be inside my head and think that someone's doing it less or more than me?
Good point. Oh,
where do you stand on this one, Dan?
I think it depends on what we're defining as a man. I know. I mean, that makes it a lot more of a convoluted question. But I think I would say the short answer is not necessarily. I think the idea that men think about sex. And I guess we're talking from the perspective of like they're wanting sexual conquest or seeking sexual congress. I think for a lot of men, depending on your situation, I think for a lot of men, they are probably driven a lot more by the need for sexual gratification from sex, I think. So I think men think more about the physical gratification that comes from sex and the gratification that comes from the release or climaxing during sex. Whereas I think women, and more specifically, the feminine hemisphere of the brain, consider sex with a lot more creativity behind it. So an easy way to I think about it is like, when men think about sex, they send a dick pic. Whereas what would probably solve them a lot more is that women have more, think of more about a dickscription. So like a man will send a picture to a woman of his hard penis. And what I guess a lot of men understand is that what would be a lot more rewarding for both parties is if you give context to the picture of this penis. Like a woman would want to know what you were thinking about specifically that led to you having an erection. What were you thinking about her doing? What position was she doing it in? Where were we doing it? So once you add the context as to why you had an erection, then it comes a lot more confirmation than someone just sending you a picture of a hard penis, which doesn't make any sense.
Which men are still doing, by the way.
Of course they are.
I don't know why they haven't got the memo. Like, I am not interested in exactly what you said. I'm not interested. I mean, I'm not interested in a dick pic, even with context. But without context, I'm just like, this is doing nothing for me. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, well, you know? I think in that case, the phallus is like an antenna for toxic masculinity. And I think a lot of the time is that, and I think that's a large part of the suggestion that men constantly think about sex, is that it's supposed to be part of their makeup of their masculinity complex. Is the idea is that you should be constantly as a hunter-gatherer pursuing sexual congress and sexual gratification and trying to emulate this whole state of clubbing a woman over the head and dragging her back to a cave as much as possible. But obviously we know there are so many other external factors that are part of, you know, the human experience, that sex alone isn't a big part of it. And I always say to people as well, when I talk to friends about issues about sex and relationships, is that I feel there's a reason why sexuality was referred to as a flower. I mean, it's more specifically people talking about women's virginity being like a flower. And I think it's more because of the fact that a flower or any kind of plant as it grows is affected by both nature and nurture. So that flower and how it blooms and its plumage and how it's angled depends on the experiences it has. So for most people, depending on if you experience some form of sexual trauma or not, or if you grow up in an environment where you're able to be open about sex, or, you know, you may not be dealing with other aspects of your mental health, which may not affect your libido. I think that everyone's sexuality is so different. And I think the problem comes from the fact that is when we try to observe a sort of groupthink when it comes to sexuality. I think everyone's sexuality is different in terms of, like, you know, like I said, just like any kind of flower, the arrangement of the pollen, the plumage is all very different. And I think everyone's sexuality is different. Wow. Everyone has a state where they might be like voraciously craving sex. And then sometimes it's like it's the last thing on their mind. Like for men, it's like a weird quantum whereby up until the point before orgasm, sex and the gratification that comes from sex and you being close enough to touch the face of God is all that you're thinking about. After you come, I would much rather be further away from vagina if I tried. There's like a split 30 seconds where I'm like, get this away from me.
Dane, you just went from one of the most eloquent things I've ever heard you say on this 88 hours to something so directly succinct. It was incredible. The thing about it is attitudes that around you, absolutely, right? I really think that plays a huge role in it. Like, you know, I don't know if our listeners know kind of Poppy, where you kind of grew up, but like, for you growing up, were you kind of encouraged particularly, or was it kind of like a
encouraged
real...
what? To have sex?
Well, I mean, like, I know people, like, I look at kind of my wife, who often comes up on this podcast, and, you know, I think her family were just very free, happy people who kind of the idea that the three children in my wife's family were going off to, you know, find romance was perfectly kind of accepted and encouraged by her family. Whereas I don't think that's the case for a lot of people, right?
No, growing up, so I'm kind of second generation British Bangladeshi. My parents are quite traditional, quite conservative, quite religious. And we just were like, I got my sex education in Quran class from another 9-year-old. Do you know what I mean? It was like a joke. Did not get it in school. And so what I think tends to happen, and I can't speak, so Rubina and I are two very different types of brown, and we're two very different types of Muslim, even though we're both mm-hmm. Sunni. I come from, like, if this was the spectrum, the kind of hardcore but not ISIS end of the spectrum, like, it's quite strict. And it's what we do, and this is the big joke and this is the biggest irony, right? So, like, what the community does, the aunties, the uncles, the imams, what they do is they make sex, like, they put it on such a pedestal mm-hmm. that what tends to happen is that it comes out of normal, like, it comes out of me and other men and women in very, not unhealthy, but in sort of awkward ways. So normal white teenagers, and sorry, I'm using white, but basically non-Asians, will get to experience it. They, you know, they'll kiss someone behind a bike shed or whatever the fuck it is. You know, they'll do stuff. Whereas we're so inhibited and repressed from having all those experiences that it comes out and manifests in the quite, unhealthy, sometimes maybe problematic ways. So what then tends to happen, like, for example, in our culture, you can marry your cousin, right? You can marry your first cousin. In fact, I married my first cousin. And so when you're playing with your cousins, you are sexualized at such a young age, because I remember playing with my cousins and aunties and uncles giving me the eye at the age of 8 or 9. Like, I was so young. I had no idea why they were looking at me that way. It's only when I got to 10, which is still a child, mm-hmm. 10, 11, I was like, oh, that's why they're looking at me funny. So inadvertently, they sexualize you, or they make you understand. They put sex in the room without mm-hmm. meaning to. And so you grow up with, like, sex is this thing I can't do. And then, you know, you start sort of...
And women are, like, the passive acceptors of what's happening to them. We're the ones being stared at. We're the ones being told what to do. We're the ones that are alarmed with a literal rape alarm when we walk down the street. But then imagine being a brown woman who comes from quite a strict culture where even dressing funny, speaking yeah. funny, doing anything that's seen outside of your culture could be quite difficult. So we always say that maybe on Brown Girls Do It Too, we take it too far because we are oversteering. We're doing exactly, we're like rebelling against everything, and then maybe we take it too far. Mm. But that's just your way to, if you're like a little bit radical and like a little bit over the top with some of the sexual things that you say, if you're overly sexually explicit, you've already taken it there.
Absolutely.
So there's loads of room for people to come up behind you.
I think it's a really good point you bring up in terms of the fact that, you know, women are a lot more repressed. And I think that's more the issue rather than if men think about sex more than women. I think social suggestion and engineering prevents women or robs women of the nomenclature required to articulate their sexuality or to assert it in the same way that men can. So, for example, I had a bit in a show I did a couple of years ago where I was like, you know, this is why it's called dictionary, because men are able to refer to their phalluses in public and in public paradigms however they want. And each man, each culture, each subculture within that culture will have their own nomenclature to describe their phallus and to describe their sexual congress. Whereas with women, like, you really only hear women referring to their genitals in casual or colloquial terms, normally in pornography. Because if you as a woman go into a room and say something like, oh no, I'm just making sure that my pants fit around my pussy correctly, everyone will be like, oh, what the f-? It's almost as a woman, depending on the language you use to describe your sexuality, that becomes an interpretation of you are asking for sex. Even if you might just be using casual terms which you use amongst your friends, but if a woman speaks explicitly about sex, it's almost as if you are giving consent to all the listeners that are listening to your narrative, is that you're allowed to have people allowed to have sex with you. But I think it's like you said, Poppy. I mean, I think it's very much seen. I think the main thing about sex as well is that, with in terms of cisgender heterosexual people, I can only speak for anyway, is that men are definitely taught, because of the taboo about sex, that is something you take from someone, as opposed to it being an exchange between two parties. And so when men are thinking about sex, it's almost if they're thinking it through the same lens as capitalism, is that it's a zero-sum game. And I have to gain for somebody else to lose, including the person I'm going to have sex with. And that complex becomes more compounded as time goes on, because then men, because they feel like they are taking something that is sordid and they are dealing with a taboo subject, then they, I'm not saying this as an excuse, but it's like, then men don't even learn how to ask for sex properly. So instead of actually asking for sex or articulating wanting sexual gratification with another party, then it becomes, well, I can't just say to a woman out and out that I want to fuck her. So I've got to maybe use some alcohol to loose her inhibitions. And if that doesn't work, then I have to put something in this alcohol so that I can't have this woman talk to me. Because if she tells me no, or if she articulates what her criteria is sexually, and I find that myself, then I'm insecure or find myself wanting wanting, because I'm not able to satisfy said criteria, then that as a man is, that takes away from my masculinity. So I have to find some way around it.
There's so many layers, right? There's so many layers. And I think what makes it actually very difficult and kind of why we can never fully answer this question is the fact that there's some very, very deep sociological, psychological elements that Dane talked about. And then I think on the surface, and listen, you can tell me I'm just an idiot, but fine, there's some really basic ones.
Yeah.
There's some really basic ones. Like, I've got a theory, it's not popular, but I've got a theory that one of the reasons men are more obsessed by sex than women is because of boobs. I think boobs, genuinely, because you've got to remember, you know, obviously you guys are attracted to us, our chests are pleasant, but not quite as eye-catching as...
Yeah, boobs are great.
Boobs are great. Yeah, we can all agree.
I don't have any, so I can't.
Listen, Poppy, boobs are like publicity. There is no such thing as bad boobs once it's out there. What happened?
Fine, I've got tiny little man girls.
They are, I think, the kind of, if you were trying to, you know, because we don't ever want to demean or insult anyone's intelligence on the show, but, you know, we all have higher and lower levels of intelligence in each human, right? We're not all completely cerebral all the time. And it's just this power that they seem to have, boobs, that I think will often make a man just kind of go,
Well, it's very primal because it's fertility, because this is the thing, is that we always have to remember when we consider sex in our civilization is that sex initially existed for us as mammals for the purpose of our procreation. We've been able to take that and distill the physical act of sexual gratification from the act of reproduction. And that's kind of what makes it also quite complicated as well, because remember, you have to remember that, according to Abrahamic text, that prostitution is the oldest profession in the world. And in some ways...
I thought it was farming.
Well, I mean, farming is more of a subsistence practice, because you farm because I can exchange my wheat for, like, your milk. So it doesn't have... Whereas with prostitution, it's like I'm exchanging just a commodity for a want as opposed to a need. So that's why it's kind of a profession, because everything else is like... Farming is like... It's a practice, but with farming in a structure of commerce, I would exchange my crops for crops that I can't grow. Whereas, you know... There's not enough corn to buy some good pussy, Poppy, if that's what you want to hear. And no one wants to buy any dick. So.
I don't know about Rabina, but like the way you just described boob, I think most women don't see our own boobs that way. Like for us, it could not be like on the opposite end of that spectrum. For me, like I don't have any kids. But it's like, it's a function. It's like, it's for the child. Like, there's nothing sexual about it at all. And I think that's where the paradox sometimes...
I don't find my own boobs sexual, but I definitely find other women's boobs sexual. Like, if I see a woman who's got a big cleavage, I will definitely look. 100%.
I will look, but I'm not on that man flex, like, boob, sex. I would just think, oh, she's got a nice...
And this is the interesting thing, because what the question is asking is... How often do you think about sex? What is thinking about sex? Is it thinking about someone naked? Is it thinking about someone penetrating you? Is it thinking about, does that lamp look like a penis? It could be anything.
Well, yeah, but like I said, it's how you consider, it's what you consider sex, because when I was a prepubescent kid, then boobs would have been as sexual as it got. Like, oh my God, boobs! I was a kid, it'd be like, that girl, I can see her shoulder. Oh my God, what are these feelings I'm feeling inside? She's showing her shoulder to everyone. So that was what was considered sexual. Or if a girl wore makeup and we were like, oh my God, makeup. So like, I guess what you consider to be sexually arousing can change as time goes on. But like I said, it's what is considered sexual, because depending on where you are in the world, like for some people, like for example, dancing is something that is very, very sexual. And what you find is, like, particularly in Bollywood and stuff, is that where people can't just demonstrate, like, you know, affection so overtly on screen, then that's done through dance. And even dance normally is what precedes sexual congress, which is why when you get married, the idea is you're supposed to be married so you can actually have sex lawfully, but that is preceded by a first dance. Or if you go to parts of... Yeah, it's foreplay. Or parts of the Mediterranean, it's like belly dancing, where it's normally repressing other women. It's like, and again, it refers back to fertility and stuff like that as well. So I think men and women think about sex as often as each other, because, you know, that's how we reproduce as human beings. I just think it's our considerations of sex. So I think that men consider the physical aspect or the aspect of physical gratification of sex more than women do, because, you know, which is why, like, you have blow-up dolls and glory holes, and, like, men will put their dicks in watermelons. We know this. You know, or the fact that like a man could be a heterosexual man his entire life, and if he finds himself incarcerated for some reason, then begins to observe a homosexual relationship. No, you know, might not have the same inclination for homosexuality, but it's like, I need to come. This is how it's done.
Any hole is a goal.
And, you know, that's something you see a lot more frequently to people that have a phallus. Whereas as I said, with women, it's not just a question of, you know, the gratification of climaxing. I think it's a completely sensory thing. And I think that's more to do with not just the rigid or binary aspect of gender. I think it's because the feminine part of the brain deals with creativity. And so when you are fantasizing, if your brain is able to generate more power from the feminine hemisphere, then it manifests as, you know, this is why women don't just masturbate. Women can masturbate and have a sex toy and have candles and erotica because you're able to incorporate.
I wish I was into candles.
What do you have instead of candles?
I've got nothing. I've got all this hair.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because with dreams, they say in dreams, if you dream about like hair or pulling hair, that represents sexuality in dreams as well. Whereas actually having sex in dreams, it represents something a lot more platonic. So if you ever dream about having sex with a friend.
Rubina and I were saying every time we have sex, we don't have sex together, but when we dream about something, it always ends in us wanting to have sex to troubleshoot and end the problem. It's very weird.
It represents intimacy.
Like, I could be dreaming about anything and I'd be like, if I have sex with this person, it'll be fine. And Rubina,
it's your subconscious showing you that, you know, if you could observe intimacy with that person, then you can have more of a platonic bond as opposed to just being physically sexual. Right. Whereas if you dream about like stuff like hair, then that's supposed to be quite overtly sexual. So, yeah.
It's a hell of a question, and we probably have learned quite a lot. I hope our listeners have learned some stuff in that question. I can tell you that, just personally from one perspective, that once you have a child, your relationship with boobs change because someone else needs them much more than you do.
Oh, poor Howard. The adventure playground became a cafeteria.
He looked at them the other day, Dane, and I was like, I remember looking at them like that. But you know, it's been. But I'm going to ask a question that is probably, you know, on the same train of thought about kind of sex and identity, because we have Poppy and Rubina here who describe themselves as brown girls in your show, right? I'm cool to say that still.
Yeah, you're fine to say that.
And we have a Dane here, a black man, and we have me, a kosher product from the Jewish
Howard, aisle. You're the only one here. Do you have kids? No. Well, then Howard, you're the only person here who we know for a fact has unprotected sex. So you.
That's a fact,
Mr. Kosher.
But the question I'm going to ask...
You're the only one here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we have this nice, assortment mix of ethnicities here. I was going to ask, is it wrong... I'm going to try and get the phrasing of this question right. Just give me a second. But should we expect different ethnic groups to have different sexual styles? Because, and I'll tell you one of the reasons I bring this up, and we'll hear from Dane shortly, because I know he's got plenty to say about this, but, you know, the black man carries a image that is not something that's ever asked for. And I don't know, you know, kind of as you describe yourself as brown girls, you know, if you feel that as that particular ethnic group, you're expected to be a certain way sexually or not.
Yeah, I think Mia Khalifa did a lot for pornography in terms of the Asian or brown stereotype when she's, you know, kind of representing the Middle East and having sex in a hijab and what that did for other brown women. And also the fact that on Pornhub, frequently in the top 10 searches in this country, the words Indian come up, the words Asian come up. You know, there is a fetishization around the cultures from Asia and then brown women and also kind of further east as well. But for us, I would 100% say I've been like fetishized by partners who have, you know, said like, oh, you know, some people have yellow fever, you know, I've got brown fever, like all of that stuff. How are they? Infect me. I don't know.
Let me be your pathogen.
I think mostly we're just seen as quite like subservient and to be dismissed, subordinate, to be dominated perhaps in the bedroom. Perhaps we're like asking for it, not asking for it. I mean, Bollywood films are all about that, right? It's like yes, no, no, yes, no, yes. And it's like, you know, really mixed up consent.
That's where I got my porn from growing up. That was where I got all my source material. So it was all of that shit, wasn't it? Yes, no, okay, take the sari, don't take the sari. It's all of that.
Yeah, it's,
you know, hardly original. Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to answer your question. I don't, can you? So hang on, what was the question? To certain,
so it's kind of like, as Rabina was saying as well, is that is there a certain level of, are there sexual stereotypes based on your ethnicity? So for example, I know for a fact, when I have partners and stuff, okay, or I've been in interracial relationships, when they may tell their friends or talk about me, before they ask about any other positive trait about my being, the first question would be, has he got a big dick? Like, does he treat you well? Mm-hmm. Do you have a spiritual connection? Is his ideological outlook something that would be good or conducive or progressive? It's just, has he got a big dick? And, you know, there, I think with the, with patriarchy and also with toxic masculinity, there's a lot of time where if you experience this objectification as a black man, a lot of people don't really, they tend to see it as more of a positive discrimination, because it's like, you know, especially when, like I said, because men will hold their self-esteem, link their self-esteem to their masculinity. It's kind of like, well, there's worse stereotypes than having a big dick, guys. Blah, blah, blah. But what a lot of people don't realize is that obviously that is very much rooted in the dehumanization of black men and the black phallus, where you be referred to as what's called a buck or a stud, where you are treated almost as if you are like a pedigree racehorse. And you'd be forced to breed with other slaves based on your, I guess, your sexual proclivity or the size of your penis. And then, and you really have no real more human dignity than that of a horse. And it used to manifest in mainstream media, whereby like you'd have people like Rock Hudson or Fred Astaire and Cary Grant, and they would be like, they'd be sexual monks, they would dance and stuff, but they'd also be considered love interests. Whereas as a black man, if you watch something like pornography, it's like your phallus or black phallus might appear having sex with a woman of a different race, but you don't even see this guy's face or hear how he speaks. He's literally just there for the penis. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is that you become further and further commodified until, what can happen then is that your sexuality can then be weaponized against you, whereby if you even appear to make any kind of advance, and what me and my friends notice a lot is that, like, if I perform a show and if I'm having a discussion with a non-black woman, then, and she has, especially if she has a white boy, a white partner, who, you know, himself may have some kind of fetishized his partner, then he sprints over to see what we're talking about. And he's like, hey, what's happening here? Wow. Is this my girlfriend? Because of toxic masculinity, this idea has been built up that, like, I lead every conversation with my penis. And I'm like, hey, Rabina Puppet, I'm Dane Baptiste. Nice to meet you. Let me move some of these glasses off the table with my dick. And you were saying, I'm sorry, my dick was too close to my right here. Let me put it behind my shoulders.
The reality of it has to be that you can know some things that could be relevant, but ultimately each individual person is going to be an individual person, right? There's no way anyone could ever expect anything from a partner because of their ethnic background, right? But there are loads of expectations put on that, I think.
Yeah, but you've got to make quick judgments, don't you? You've got to, like, sex is kind of about quick attraction. So maybe sometimes categorizing people like that is just really useful for your brain to be like, well, I'm going to put that person there and that's why I like them or don't like them. Like, I once went out on a date with a guy who on the date told me that he was into hairy women. And I was like, cool, that's weird. And then I was like, oh shit, you think that because I'm brown that I'm going to be having, you're right. You are right. But where do you want the hair to be? Like, what are you interested in? And he was interested in, like, hairy arms, hairy legs. And I was like, okay, well, I came on a date, so I don't know if that's, where are we going with this? I'm not going to let you shave me.
He was probably like, check, please. What a jib. This is ridiculous.
So you're talking about sexual stereotypes based on ethnicity. The subservient thing is definitely rings true, but I always get a lot of, like, so can you eat pork? What do you think of ISIS then? Obviously, this is back in the, you know what I mean? Like, really fucking lame shit questions. And you're like, all right, cool. Let's hit me with question one then. Let's go. You know, so it would be weird. It would be that sort of less about sex, or maybe because I do like being dominated in the bedroom, I sort of didn't see it. Do you know what I mean? I was just like, well, that's my kind of sexual preference anyway. So I didn't really.
Or maybe it's your internalized stuff that you put on yourself. This is another thing.
Which definitely works. I have a perfect example of that is the fact that since they've been told that blondes have more fun, even though blonde hair is genetically recessive, to this day, when women are trying to express the most quintessential example of sexual objectification, blonde hair, blue eyes, big boobs, And you see that repeated with all the iconoclasts in Western culture from Marilyn Monroe onwards, because you've had like Marilyn Monroe, and then you've had like Anna Nicole Smith and Kate Upton and Erica Elenak and Pamela Anderson. Yeah, and it just goes on and on. But it's kind of like whenever you see a lot of the time women are trying to reimagine themselves as more affable, particularly to patriarchal ideas of sexuality, then they tend to take on that whole persona. So I think a lot of the time we do tend to internalize it, and we internalize how we're supposed to look. And I think it largely comes from the fact that because sex is so commodified, then in the same way that people want to pick out a nice dress and they will look for a partner or a sexual partner in the same way, where it's kind of like...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If people are taking... So, for example, there was a time, I suppose, early noughties, where there were a lot of crossover Asian films that were big in cinema. So you had, like, Bend It Like Beckham and Bride and Prejudice. And for people, that could be enough for people to just get, like, a straight, like, what you describe as, like, brown fever, where people kind of like, oh, yeah, like, you know, I just recently watched Best Marigold Hotel, so I'm just wondering if... we could.
What a chat line!
That's all it takes sometimes.
90% of the best Marigold Hotel.
After Saved the Last Dance came out, like, I don't want to go out in university after that, because everyone's just sitting. All the white girls are sitting there like bouncing back and forth like fucking Julia Stiles. I'm not teaching them to dance. It's not happening.
I've got to point out here, we've been talking about this question for a little while now. Sorry. And it's important to say that it has not sprung to the front of our minds the sexual identity of the Jewish populace. And there's a reason for that. There's a big reason for that, right? We are not the sexy brand ethnic.
I disagree. Have you seen Natalie Portman in Closer?
Oh, yeah.
And Clive Owen goes, let me see your pussy.
You can find him.
Goodness gracious, Clive Owen. That's what I'm saying.
But the Jews, the thing, you know, you kind of, who, I mean, you said the dick thing, and then, you know, there's been a few examples of how we're, the Jewish thing is genuinely, like, I would have gone on dates with, and I'm not religious, but, you know, I would have gone on dates and people would have been like, so do you have sex through a sheet? I mean, at the time, I would have said, I'll have sex through anything you want. I'll sex through this door if you need to. But, like, you know, whatever is whatever. But there is these kind of, and obviously, you know, we all have the snip, us guys.
A lot of black guys are very big on circumcision as well.
And Muslim men.
And Muslim men as well, yeah.
Crew.
There's a massive intersectionality there as well. So, yeah.
But I would say the Jewish brand is not one defined by its sex appeal, generally. I don't think people were like, oh, we need to, you know, this music video isn't quite sexy. It's not quite Jewish enough. You know, we need to make it.
But what about Gene Simmons from Kiss? I think he definitely tried to subvert that whole idea, right?
You can find those examples.
And what you tend to find as well, Howard, is that it's a weird dichotomy where normally when you have a group where the women in that particular group are fetishized by Western attitudes, a lot of the time the male contingent of that same group is very much effeminized or kind of reduced, because there's a real ongoing discussion about colorism within the black community, for example, whereby fairer skin is seen as a lot more effeminate and more attractive and more reminiscent of Eurocentric features. And that's normally for women. However, for fairer skinned men, it seems to be a lot more effeminate. And there's been like a weird shift again, where I think late 90s or like mid 90s, I think it was like fairer skinned men were all the rage. Whereas now, as soon as they're a lot more effeminate and it's supposed to be like a lot less of an aspiration to be the fair-skinned man, whereas a woman that would be described now colloquially as exotic or foreign is preferred to a darker-skinned woman. I'm not sure it's the same for the Asian diaspora. I'm sure there are elements of it, because I think I've heard it myself, whereby Pakistanis are too light, but then Southern Indians are too dark, Sri Lankans are too dark, and Gujaratis are fair, and that's okay, but yeah.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Poppy? Where do you think it?
We're on the we were talking. We recorded an episode of Brown Girls Suit 2 yesterday, and we were talking about colorism, sort of this internal racism. But it kind of goes beyond colorism. Well, in that I'm a Sunni Bengali. If I brought home a Hindu or like a Shia Gujarati, like that would not be allowed. I mean, the criteria is so small. It's so finite. It's like village, back home, cousin, tick, tick, tick. Bangladeshis are not that bad with cousin marriages. Pakistanis are quite, you know, they're still doing it. It's like the gene pool is very, very small because we want to propagate the progeny, the language, the culture, the everything. Also, my mum's been in this country for 35 years and doesn't speak a word of English. So for her, it's incredibly important that her sons-in-laws speak the language, because obviously, you know, we marry families, we don't marry the individuals.
You can understand why we're protective of it as well. You know, like colonialism made brown people feel terrified about losing anything, and then they carry the trauma of your like parents to, you know, you understand why you're protective of the things that belong to you. And you also understand why we do think in that Eurocentric way, why we think white people are more attractive than us, because that's what we've been taught, that's what our parents have been taught.
Well, that's where beauty first became commodified, and if you look at the cosmetic industry, like that's a large, it's a large arm in trying to maintain the choke of colonialism. Because it's like, for example, you look at like perfume adverts. Really, a perfume advert is trying to sell you a scent, so really the aesthetic shouldn't really matter. But if you look at most perfumes, it's like an alabaster skinned woman eating an apple, and there's a fox. Usually naked. Then she
always
eats. Then a fox is about to come
naked
and lick her pussy, and then he just goes obsession. And you go, what?
or a man,
yeah. And then he turns into a wolf, and then a man's about to save her, and it's just like,
yeah.
And the man is crazy. So I just slight tangent, but come back with me. So a very good friend of mine lives in Brazil, and he came back to London after years of living in Brazil. And he was like, I've noticed something. Something's happened. I was like, what? And he's like, all the couples doing bank adverts are mixed race. It's always a black guy and a white woman. That's amazing. What happened? And I was like, yeah. I mean, I started noticing it as well. Sorry, I don't know how it was related. But going back to the beauty ideals, I think I'm seeing a change now, like now, but it's very slow. Like I'm seeing more black models with hijab wearing models, Asian models, Indian models. So, but it's very slow. I mean, it's only now.
Yeah, it's definitely slow. And I think sexuality and beauty can very easily be dictated by what images are on a billboard. And I think people kind of underestimate how much that affects image and how much that can affect suggestion and ideas of sexuality and attraction. So,
well, it was a fun question because we got to dive into quite a lot of stuff there, and it's carried on this sexual trajectory of this episode, Dane. So I don't know if you're going to carry that on with your question or not.
I think that with two ladies here, we should give them the full hour, Howard. I would not be a gentleman if I didn't keep it going. You keep going to the end, Howard. That's what a real man would do. So, so my question, I think, is hopefully rather a simple one, and it's just based on the fact that I think it's a great thing that you guys are doing. I think, as I said before, I think a lot of people are unaware of how frequent and how many women globally suffer sexual trauma before they're even able to assert their own sexuality. Most men may or may not know 80% of most women experience some form of sexual trauma before their 19th birthday. So I feel like it's very important to be able to give people the tools and the confidence to discuss their sexuality from both negative and positive aspects. But I would say I still have a lot to learn. So I guess it's quite a generalized question, but I want to just ask, based on, you know, the work you've done, interviews you've had, research you guys have done, sexually, how do you think brown girls are doing at this particular stage? Because, like, you know, I'm someone who's visited, like, now I've never been so far east as all the way to, say, like, the subcontinent, but I've been to Australia, which obviously has a large population of the Asian diaspora, and if I hadn't gone somewhere like Australia, I wouldn't really be experiencing narratives from people who necessarily are from Bangladesh or from Sumatra or Sri Lanka. But then you do find that there's a large contingent of the same diaspora in places like the Arab Emirates, where which is seen on the surface being a bit more liberal. And even though, obviously, it's a place where a large amount of the indigenous population wear hijabs, I also know that when Victoria's Secret opened in Dubai, they'd have bid about 20 million in their first week. So obviously someone's getting it sexy for somebody out there. So yeah, how are you finding it? Are you finding if you guys are at dinner parties with your peers and your racial and ethnic contemporaries and you start talking to them, it's like, you guys are bringing shame on us? Or they're like, right on, sisters.
It depends on the age group, right?
You tell me, Poppy.
Talk to anyone else. Well, I mean, I think if you talk to anyone else of our age and younger, it's like, how much time do you have? Let's put it all out there. But you would, you look at some of the comments, because we get loads of trolls. You get, it's Beshalem, which means someone with shame. Shame is something. I often always say to Rabina, like, if we made a brown version of I May Destroy You.
Yes, yeah.
The Michaela Collins story. Like, the shame and honor and reputation is like a physical thing that we carry. Like, it's so present in our community. So I think brown women are definitely talking about it more, but I don't know if they've, I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but like, even when we're booking guests for this season, people, I found that women who I thought would be like way more open and like obviously cooler than me would be like, and they're quite guarded about it. So I think we still have a long way to go. But
I say this because a bit of extra background. One of the first comedians I ever saw perform live was Russell Peters, and I was 15. And I remember he made a very good point where he said how like people give, we are stigmatized as being sexually repressed on the subcontinent. But how can that be the case when there are 1.1 billion of us? So someone's fucking.
Yeah, we're doing a good job of it. Yeah,
also, the karma super comes from there. So obviously we understand how sex works. But what's the experience been like in the tide turning? Because, I've spoken to other influencers from a similar background. We'll say they're like a Pakistani upbringing, but her parents are from the Middle East originally. And and she just makes it good because you guys mentioned Mia Khalifa before as well. And she was kind of saying, because I was like, I think it's good on the one hand that, like you said, it's the aesthetic is opening up for other women that want to be able to celebrate their sexuality. But at the same time, she doesn't normally wear a hijab in her normal life. So is that just you playing for the gallery of Western fetishization, as opposed to just doing it because you want to? So I just wanted to get your thoughts rather than presume.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, look, the sex sells, right? We know that actually sex can be funny. Give us a chance to be funny. We choose the podcast so that we can practice some of our jokes on each other and make each other laugh mostly and say like dick and pussy as many times as possible and still be teenagers about it. Like, we love that.
That's 25% of my opinion, Rabina. I completely understand.
But I guess like when you ask like are brown women, how are they doing? I mean, from my following stuff on Instagram and looking at how India is this amazing emerging economy with all sorts of diverse voices coming through, like just go to Instagram and see what like young people in India are doing. Some of it's so interesting. And I think there are lots of brown women in India. I mean, the Masala podcast is, run by a woman who grew up in a slum in India. We had her as a guest on our show, and she's so smart. She's obsessed with sex toys and has all this kind of new way of thinking and new way of like getting people to talk about stuff. I think there is a great movement towards it, but I agree with Poppy. We still have a long way to go because we're often seen as a part of a family and a part of a network. And a part of a community. And I'm sure that everybody who, whatever community you come from, you often feel like you have to represent your community. And I'm not doing Brown Girls Do It Too to represent all brown girls. The title might be a bit misleading, but I'm not. I can only represent me. And part of what we do is talk about stories. It's all about our anecdotes. What happened to me when I was dating? How I lost my virginity. I have to tell those stories as an individual, and I can't speak broadly about brown women. Mm-hmm. Again, there are billions of us, and their stories are also different and diverse. We just want to show a side of it you don't often see. Yeah. We're not the terrorist, or we're not the doctor, or we're not the kind of, Pretty Patel of the world. Yeah. We can be other things. Sometimes we can just be idiots, and the podcast actually just lets us be idiots for once.
Yeah. I think that's maybe a big part of the journey is diffusing that grenade that is normally thrown into the room when it comes up, this discussion about sexuality within culture and stuff as well. So No, I think it's really cool. Do you find, because I guess I'm trying to find the intersectionality between both communities in that, like, you have a contingent of people from the African diaspora who are very open about, you know, the fluidity of gender, the LGBT community. You know, you have great people like Monroe Bergdorf, and she's been able to definitely be an amazing ambassador for the Black trans community. And yes, are you finding there's an equivalent kind of movement beginning to manifest within your own communities? And obviously there are nuances too, because like you said, it's Asian, but it's a very umbrella term to describe both of your experiences. So I'm asking you individually if you're seeing amongst like Pakistani and Bangladeshi community changes and this
evolution.
I am, but I just don't think we're there yet. Honest to God, like if I'm being completely honest, like it's great that in 2020, in a pandemic, 2019 technically, that we were given a platform to talk about sex and relationships and growing up and all that stuff. But I really don't think we are. And maybe it's skewed because I see the comments and I look at the way, I listen to the way our guests sometimes speak to us and they're quite guarded and they're obviously thinking about something and, you know, they're obviously holding back a bit, which is totally fine. We want people to be as candid as possible, but we want them to be comfortable. But I think as a community, and I speak for the Bangladeshi community, I just don't think we're there yet. I think we are still quite far behind, but I think it's great that social media has given people a platform to speak and it's amplified those thoughts and sentiments and experiences. But, you know, my sister works for a train company. This Bengali guy was just like, "You're not married. What's wrong with you?" I mean, she's 32. And he was saying it so openly and so casually. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm trying to say from that story is that our generation's not the problem. We're still ruled by the, you know, kind of iron fist of my parents' generation. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go to my mum, when I'm knocking on my mum's door, I turn into a Muslim. You know, I'm a part-time Muslim. Like, she still has that hold over me. So that what the community says, the elders, they still have a power.
And the tricky thing with a podcast, like you do a podcast, as you well know, you don't know if people are listening and talking about it publicly. Yeah. You guys do probably because they're promoting it. I think the thing about Brown Girls Do It Too, it's a little bit like pornography. Yeah. If you're watching it on your laptop and someone walks in, you probably shut it. You can be quite intimate and be quite quiet listening to what we're saying and message us and tell us that you're loving it, but you're not recommending it to your friends. Yeah. You're not talking publicly about listening and enjoying it. It's kind of hard to gauge how far we've got because we do get a lot of trolls and we do get a lot of people telling us like, "You're not really supposed to be doing this. Like, does your parents know?" We get that constantly.
Yeah. Do you think there's a particular catalyst that would bring about some change? So do you think, or more, I guess, the way to answer the question, do you think there's some kind of cultural compromise that can be found whereby, you know, you are still celebrating and holding on to certain elements of cultural norms while still being able to enjoy, like, you know, your sexuality or sexual congress with a partner or multiple partners? I don't know.
Will it just be time?
Because
By the time that the age of your parents' generation now.
Because it's quite paradoxical, whereby you have, like you said, at a more extreme end of the spectrum with, like, I'd say, with Islamic belief, where it's kind of like, on the one hand, women should be repressed and had their modesty. That's right. Oh, none of my wives got to be modest. When I check into a 5-star hotel with, oh, none of these fine wives. Behave yourself in the eyes of God. I don't even know.
He's a bad Muslim. He's only allowed four.
Well, there you go. or where guys go to, you find people going to Morocco and being like, "No sex before marriage. All right, I'm going to marry this woman of my dreams for a week." And then.
Or just do anal.
And do anal. Exactly.
Yeah. That's what most people do.
So controversially, I think that, like, my answer to this is, ultimately, in Islam, you cannot have sex before marriage. Mm-hmm. You cannot cohabit before marriage. And I think really that is where some of the friction is. Mm-hmm. Like, till that changes, and that's not going to change, mm-hmm. you're always going to have that kind of resistance. Mm-hmm. I would like to think maybe in 300 years time, things will be different, but
I think that what could really shift things is if Bollywood took some responsibility with sex and instead of hiding it behind saris, actually once maybe did a film that was a blockbuster that billions of people saw that actually had people having sex. And it didn't have to be graphic. It could just be, look, they're not kissing and then cuts to a flower.
Channel 5 saxophone sex. You know how it is. I mean, it takes a woman 10 seconds to lift up her back and then there'd be the sweat and goes, "Let's have a cigarette in your bra afterwards, like you normally do with sex." That was realistic sex.
It's such a challenge, though, right? Because what it is cultural law or kind of ethics, which comparatively to like, so if I'll give you a comparative example in my head that offers why you know you're not going to solve this anytime soon is that, you know, like weed, right? Like I can tell you pretty much categorically that I think within the next generation or two, majority of places will legalize weed because it's just too good a business, really. But also there's just a load of reasons for it. Yeah. And that's also generational, right? Because by the time that we're in our 50s or 60s, obviously we won't care. Everyone can smoke weed, it's fine. But that's something that is actual law. Whereas I think kind of when you're looking at these cultural situations, you're never going to get a consensus in that way, right? It's just not going to be possible for all of the different families with different backgrounds. And like, you know, Dane said much earlier in this episode, you know, your own personal attachments, you know, those people will still have had good and bad experiences that will influence how they view things, you know. So it's a tough one to get a consensus on, right?
I mean, obviously, it's a good point, McHoward. I suppose with the weed, it's almost gone the same way as alcohol with prohibition in the States, where I got to a point where it's like, the loss of revenue and this how it's affecting it was the byproducts of the repression and what that was causing. And so maybe that can be the way it goes, because I feel like, once. I guess there needs to be a larger global discussion about a discourse about consent. I think the main thing is patriarchy has a lot to do with it. You know, as I said before at the start of the show, it's the idea that men have to take sex from women rather than have it offered to them. I think when we talk about sex in terms of birth control and sexual rights of women, I genuinely believe a lot of the time men who feel they need to discuss a woman's right to choose know somewhere esoterically if that she could choose, they would not be here. Or maybe that's the fear. Maybe there's that, because I think maybe that's part of it, is that there's an existential fear that men feel that if women have autonomy over their own wombs, then a lot of them may not be able to survive. Because like I said, the idea of sex is for you to pass on your seed and for you to continue your own gene pool. And if we are...
I kind of think we should shift the power back to women. Give us more power
I think there's a big part of fear is that if the autonomy is returned to women in the strictest Darwinian sense, if the choice, of a partner or the choice of an alpha male is down to not to the social systems that men have created, like their standing in society, where it's based on a caste system or based on their finances and maybe just based on their own sexual and masculine prowess, then a lot of men wouldn't be able to reproduce. And I think a lot of men are fucking shit scared of that. But I just feel like, my message to men is like, women like sex too, and don't worry, if they wanted you gone, you wouldn't even be here. So just relax, dudes. They're giving you boobies. It's a fairground and a cafeteria. What are you complaining about, man? Come on, Liz.
Well, that was a brilliant question, and it's been a brilliant episode, isn't it?
It's been an amazing episode, guys. I really thank you guys for coming on the podcast, and I really hope by that token a lot more people hear about the work you guys are doing, both from the perspective of entertainment and activism. So if people want to find out more about you, when they can find out about the podcast, please let us know.
So you can check us out. We're called Brown Girls Do It Too. We do a podcast about sex and relationships. It's kind of sex is the prison to all sorts of stuff. And we do say really silly stuff. And Poppy laughs at all my jokes. And I try to laugh at her. So if you want to hear two girls just like cackling going at it, it's quite good for that. And you can catch us on BBC Sounds. We're also on other like podcasting apps. But yeah, Brown Girls Do It Too.
And I've got to tell you guys, about 7 years ago, we had this girl come in and do work experience where I was working, and I thought she was going to be decent. And I thought you could see there's something in this person. And lo and behold, Rabina, you've smashed it. It's amazing. Proud as anything. You deserve it.
7 years. Exactly.
You're a real brown girl doing it.
And I have another tack-on question to you there. For any of our listeners, which may be of a similar or identical ethnic origin, who may have questions about their sexuality, is there any literature or anything you guys can recommend that they watch to have an understanding of themselves, as well as the podcast? Anything you recommend they read or check out, or even some of male listeners from the Asian diaspora as well, if they want to understand a lot more about the sexuality of their female contemporaries? Any recommendations?
I would check out Burnt Roti and Sharon Dhaliwal and what she does there in terms of like Asian queer spaces. There's also Gaysians run by Rita Loy. I think the stuff that she's doing with her Gaysians radio station is really good as well. So for the more queering community, I think they're really great. And if you just want to have a laugh, come to us, but we are not sex experts.
Well, experts of your own sexuality though, and that's what counts. We should all seek to be experts of our own sexuality to all of our listeners. Rubina and Poppy, it's been amazing. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us. You've made this. You've
Thank
ticked
you.
Off my bucket list of the best Asian threesome I could have ever possibly conceived of.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guests were Rubina and Poppy from Brown Girls Do It Too podcast. You can listen to that on BBC Sounds. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.